Pure Dog Talk is the podcast on purebred dogs. We talk to the legends in the sport and give you tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves, and am joined today again from the National Animal Interest Alliance Conference in Washington, D.C. I am joined by Candace Crony. She is a PhD at Purdue, and your topic for the conference was advancing canine welfare and commercial breeding operations and talking about the science-based component of that.
Yes.
And how that doesn't exist.
Yes.
So, first of all, we start everybody off. You're 411. I loved your thing about I wanted a diversity of hate mail. So, tell us how you got started in this particular project.
I have a really long history of working in animal welfare and also studying ethics associated with animal care practices and public perceptions of those. And there I was minding my own business in the lovely ivory tower we have set up for faculty at Purdue University when I got an email. One of our representatives for the Indiana Council for Animal Welfare, who wanted to invite me to a meeting where the dog breeders represented by that group were going to talk about creating standards for dog welfare.
Wow. I mean, this is a wow.
Wow moment. Then I heard a little bit more about what that group was about and what sorts of breeders they were. And I confess, I was a little nervous and frankly wasn't sure that was something that I wanted to be involved with, because to be honest, I had the same information about commercial dog breeding, which actually is not a term I had known before, and all the negative connotations and associations that come with that. However, it was made very clear to me that these folks were sincere. They really wanted to learn. They really wanted to understand what it was that people were expecting from them in terms of dog welfare. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to know what they could do better.
Which is a huge step. I mean, they're coming to you, to someone at Purdue University, to someone who's in a major position and asking for help.
Absolutely. And it would have been much easier to say, no, I'm too busy or I'm not going to help with this, because I can't reiterate enough how concerned I was that potentially what was going to happen is I'd have a group who were just going to try to trade on my name to market themselves better, but weren't really interested in improving quality of life for dogs.
Right.
And after a lot of consideration, I thought, I'll go to the meeting. I'll at least learn something new. Give them the benefit of the doubt and see what they're really about. And I went into that meeting and I was incredibly ashamed of myself and a little humbled, because what I heard was a group of people who got the message that folks weren't happy with the dogs they were producing or how they were raising those dogs, but they had no understanding of what the nature of the problem was or what people weren't happy about and wanted them to do differently.
Right.
And I also got very clearly that there was a sincere desire to not just do better in terms of marketing themselves or do better in terms of public perceptions. They really wanted to learn as much as they could so they could do the best possible job at raising these dogs, right? Which, to their credit, they'd actually thought they were doing a pretty good job until they started hearing all of the concerns.
So they were willing to hear the concerns and try to improve. Huge.
Absolutely. And it's rare when you do the kind of work that I do to have a group that really is worried about being put out of business, legislated out of practice, and so on, take the proactive stance of saying, I'm not going to fight these efforts over here. I want to correct the problem. And that was new and refreshing.
Awesome. Yeah. Absolutely fabulous. So you also mentioned in your presentation that despite all of the, as you mentioned, Dr. Google, what's out there from animal rights extremists or just sort of in the mythology, the urban mythology, there was no science to show what was being done. There was no research that had been done in these facilities to prove how good, bad, or indifferent they were.
Yeah, so it was very interesting to me when I first said, okay, I will work on this particular project. I will help you to draft science-based standards for the care and well-being of your dogs. Not for how to breed dogs, because, let's face it, dog breeders sort of already have that covered. But really, I'm going to pay close attention to what's already published, what is already out there in terms of codes of practice and established science relative to these key areas that absolutely have to be addressed. Those are basics: food, water, housing, general nutrition requirements, health, and so on. And then, given that there's so much concern about the genetic health of these animals, right, and the behavioral soundness of them as well, really build on that and add that component in there, right? And also address and raise many of the ethical questions that other people have, which I think are valid questions to ask, which includes what happens to these dogs at the end of their breeding careers. We bring them into this world. It's important we give them a good quality of life, and we plan for the end of their lives and the end of their working careers. They're not disposable items,
right?
They're living, sentient beings. And we owe them that consideration.
Right.
So these were the conversations I was starting to have with breeders. And I was surprised, because these are not easy conversations to have.
No.
And they were more than open to having them. Thus, we got started on this little journey that has no end in sight.
No. Never will end. Has overtaken your life, right?
It has definitely overtaken my life. It was amazing to me how little information there was published on management practices, husbandry practices, lots of the details, lots of the nuances that you need to write science-based standards for care relative to the species. I was floored that there was more information on livestock and poultry housing than there is on what is optimal housing for dogs. Okay. And the more I searched, the more appalled I became, because much of the existing science that really was useful and helped to inform the standards that we have was sort of outdated. Or when I tried to find original citations of papers on which factors like how much space a dog should have were based on, it turns out there really wasn't anything there.
People were just making it up.
It was actually people's professional opinions given at the time when there wasn't information and folks had to make a decision. But we can do better than that now. I'm shocked that people weren't actually studying these dogs, right? But there are reasons for that. One, who's going to fund the research?
Right.
You know, if it's industry funded, it's obviously going to, right off the bat, be questioned. And two, there's so much stigma around this type of dog breeding that relatively few people are sort of willing to take the risk of even doing work, right? You immediately become a target for some people who think this industry is awful and shouldn't operate at all. So those were some risks to take. And as I said, it was surprising how few people had actually studied this population of dogs on site, as opposed to giving reports back about dogs thought to come from some of these places, and perhaps some legitimately do.
But it's anecdotal.
But it is
nothing,
anecdotal.
There's nothing empirical about it.
Yes. It's incredibly important that when we are studying, when we are trying to set out policies and establish best practices for animals, that we're actually looking at that population of animals specifically, right? Because sometimes there are little nuances that can get missed. There are analogies that can get made. A dog is not a dog is not a dog. And with this population of dogs, based on what they're selected to do, based on how they're selected, based on whether or not people are even paying attention to selection criteria.
Right.
How the dogs are handled, how they're managed, how they're cared for, and all that in conjunction with their genetics absolutely makes them very different in terms of some of their behaviors and some of their responses compared to other dogs that we study in my lab group, including shelter dogs and people's companion dogs.
Hobby breeders. And,
absolutely. So it was eye-opening and sort of important that the more research we did, the more research there was to do. In fact, everything I presented today is a pilot study, as it has to be, because there is no basis for the literature in the areas we're studying.
And you're now going to have, you said, a journal publication on this, right?
So we have several journal publications that are either submitted in preparation or recently published. What we hope to do is have that information become publicly accessible, particularly for folks who don't necessarily have access to journals. We actually, as much as possible, try to publish in free access journals, so you don't have to pay a fee to get the articles.
Nice.
But let's face it, not everybody is really wanting to read scientific articles. We can be a little dry and boring. So we try to create these executive summaries or extension papers that are meant to reach lay audiences.
And to make the an opportunity right here, like pure dog talk.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Okay. So first of all, how many breeders were you working with, roughly?
When we first began, we had a target of 25 breeders, mm-hmm. and we had a relatively short time frame to get to all of these breeders. Mm-hmm. We got to 20 of them.
Okay. Okay, so that's a good starting place. These are yes. the 20 breeders that are in Indiana. For our listeners, Craig Curry was talking about some of that group.
Right. So not we didn't work only with Indiana breeders for our research.
Oh, good.
Much of our research is based in Indiana, and that just right. facilitates data collection and keeps costs down as far mm-hmm. as travel. Mm-hmm. But it is really important that for the work we're doing, again, keeping in mind it's a pilot study, so it's right. going to be hard for it to be representative of all breeders across the U.S., we did want to at least work with some breeders in other states. So mm-hmm. where people were willing to do that, we did. So we have worked with breeders in Missouri. There are a couple that were having conversations in Ohio. Mm-hmm. potentially, mm-hmm. and we hope to expand that out even further.
Good, good. And that's great. That's I just wanted to make sure we had kind of parameters what we needed.
Yeah.
So with that, coming up with ideas on housing and sanitation and nutrition, like you were talking about, you created this, and it's now functional, right? The Canine Care Certified.
Yes. So the standards that were worked on at Purdue, and I had the privilege of leading the writing on that, but many, many other people contributed to those standards and then edited and consistently improved them. And that includes lots of other scientists with relevant expertise, certainly included experts in reproduction, genetics, mm-hmm. behavior, other aspects of animal welfare science. But it also did include members of the NGO community who's interested in animal welfare, and we specifically the American Humane Association. And then we had listening sessions with others who were interested, and we certainly wanted to have input from breeders who are ultimately going to be impacted, and frankly would have been irresponsible not to get their feedback and their input, especially since we were inviting other groups who were interested parties to give feedback. And so we tried to have the broadest group of input possible. We had fabulous leadership from our state veterinarian and right. his office.
Right.
And we had a lot of support from USDA APHIS through their provision of a science fellow to help conduct the research.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah.
Very inclusive.
It took a village. We wanted it to be an inclusive village. But we wanted to really produce something that was strong right. and that breeders had a hand in from the ground up, right?
Absolutely.
Because it was going to be for them.
Right. So you created the Canine Care Certified Program that is now in place.
Yes.
So tell us about that.
So Canine Care Certified has actually licensed the standards that were drafted, and they now have a national program. It is a voluntary program.
Right.
None of what we do is legislative.
Fabulous.
And frankly, I like that. I think it's, well, I understand that there are some people who understandably would suggest that, well, if it's not a law, people don't have to do it, so how do you know it's really going to change the lives of dogs? Well, I'll tell you what, for the people who choose to do it, and I think that choice is important. One, they're taking all the risks up front.
Right.
So they're really putting themselves on the line, and they're trying to do it because it's the right thing to do. And that, to me, is so incredibly important because that is fundamentally ethics in action. And I think it actually sends a much better message to the public that these people are choosing to do this, and these standards are hard. Right. They're hard, and they're rigorous, as they should be, if we want to fundamentally change and improve the quality of life of dogs. There are certain things that breeders have to do, and it's hard. And the fact that these folks were willing to do it, and it's voluntary, is fabulous. I think it sends a much better message than someone's forcing you to do it. You're choosing to do the right thing.
I completely agree.
And I think that helps us to get better results.
Yeah, because they want to.
Because they want to do it.
You can lead a horse to water, man.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a real issue. So tell us about what those standards are. What do those entail? You know, high points of it.
Right. So the standards are incredibly detailed. They cover everything they should as far as basics.
Right.
So, and I think I touched on those before, food, water, shelter. They talk about space allocations for dogs. And I'll put out that we are forced to rely on imprecise information because, again, there are no studies I can find that lay out how you know how much space a dog should have and then tailors that accordingly for different breeds of dogs.
Right.
Or sizes of dogs. In addition, we talk about reproductive management of dogs. We talk about how many litters a dog can have. That's limited. Mm-hmm. We talk about when reproduction should start and when it should end.
Nice.
And on what basis you make decisions to breed dogs versus not breed dogs. And we certainly make sure that the attending veterinarian is involved in all of these decisions and signs off on them and really works very clearly with their breeders to make sure that they are making good choices based on current science that is really inclusive in terms of attending to dogs' physical needs as well as their behavioral and mental needs, right? Because people expect that. If you're going to have a dog in your home, you want to know that that dog is safe and healthy.
And was handled from the time it was a puppy.
Absolutely.
And has, you know, seen grass and all of the things that people say don't happen.
Yes. So in addition to all of those basics that I touched on, what we really wanted to make sure is that those dogs had a good veterinary care plan outlined, which includes making sure that they have dental exams. Those are incredibly important for a number of reasons. I touched on some of those in the presentation
today. I was very interesting. I had not heard the one about periodontal disease and reproductive issues. That was actually new to me. Breeding dogs for 40 years. That was very interesting.
Yes. And again, that information is not necessarily in the dog literature, but we see it in the human literature. We see it, for instance, in some of the non-human primate literature. And so it becomes really important to think about it.
Right.
But we also know that there are all these other systemic effects associated with poor dental health, as well as local effects like pain the dogs might be experiencing, right? And we don't want that for our dogs. So we addressed that. We want to make sure that was taken care of. Making sure that the dogs are clean and groomed and well cared for in that regard, that all falls under plan of veterinary care. And then, and this is what I think distinguishes what we've done from a lot of what's out there, we spent a lot of time in terms of what needs to happen to ensure that those dogs are behaviorally well as physically well. Right? And so we mandate things like socialization and exercise and enrichment for those dogs. Not because we want to tie breeders' hands. One of the things that our standards do that I thought was pretty important is they're written to be outcome-based.
Right.
So breeders, for instance, must have a written plan for socialization of their dogs.
Nice.
Okay. How those dogs become socialized is up to the breeder. I don't want to tie a breeder's hands in terms of saying, you shall only do it this way, particularly if that way doesn't work for a certain breeder, and some other way that gets the same endpoint does work. Right?
Nice.
So wherever possible, what we did is told breeders what needed to happen. We gave them examples of how other people have done it.
Right.
We gave them resources whenever possible to show them what could be done.
Right.
And then we said, go ahead and make it happen.
Have at it.
However it works for you, you make it happen, because at the end of the day, because it's outcome-based, I'm going to ask the dog how it works for them. And is it really happening?
Right.
And it is the dog's information that matters.
And so, and I thought that was really fascinating. We can't show the video, or maybe you could send me a link and we could put it up on the website, on the blog post, but something. Talk about your evaluation of the behavior. And I would love to hear, and we didn't really get into this in the discussion, in the presentation, your observation of changes.
Yes. So understanding that for many people, behavior seems intuitive, and it should seem obvious that anyone can look at a dog and know if it's doing well, is a little bit of a fallacy, right? Because you kind of have to know what you're looking for against what you've asked people to do. So there is, for instance, a very real likelihood that I could ask a breeder to do socialization of dogs. Okay? Including adult dogs, not just puppies, because it's important for both. And I might have someone check a form. Let's face it, human nature, this happens. I'm going to have someone check a form who says they're actually doing that. So the outcome for me is when I approach a dog, when a novel person approaches the dog, how's the dog respond? Because I know that the dog that is being socialized to different people, as is important for all dogs, is going to respond very differently if that's actually happening versus if it's not happening or not happening consistently, because that dog is going to give me a very different behavioral response than the dog who has those things occurring, right? And so we look for things like fearfulness, particularly excess fearfulness. We know there's individual variation in dogs. We know there are breed differences in dogs. So we're not going to be ridiculous and presume that just because a dog seems fearful or averse to a stranger showing up in their home kennel, which, let's face it, many of our dogs, depending on their breed descriptions, are meant to be guardy or aloof.
Standoffish.
Exactly. It's perfectly appropriate that there are some dogs who would tell us, you are not supposed to be here. We don't like you being here.
Right.
Okay. What should happen, and what we've set up our studies to do, is to evaluate those dogs when strangers are there, and also to evaluate on exactly the same behavioral criteria when their familiar caretakers are there.
Okay.
one of the things that tells us really clearly is if their responses are more gregarious, mm-hmm. they're happier to see you, they're more relaxed around their people, we know that those people are actually acting as stress buffers for mm-hmm. their dogs, mm-hmm. right? It tells us something about the quality of the interactions mm-hmm. and the frequency of the interactions they're having with that person. So it becomes sort of a double diagnostic, right?
Right.
The other thing that's really kind of cool is if the dog is giving us a worse response with the caretaker, that's a red flag.
Right.
Something is not quite right. That is not how that should work.
Right.
Yet again, the dogs give us information that we can rely on that's a little bit different than just relying on what someone might have told us that may or may not have been 100% accurate.
Right. And so long-term nationwide, applying this certification and hiring people who have your level of knowledge to go in and evaluate what the dogs are telling them.
Right. Here's what's important. What we never want to do is set up a program that is structured in such a way that only an expert in behavior and welfare science right. can make a judgment and it be accurate and objective. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what we have been doing is working with the auditing company who goes out and inspects and then does a third-party audit of the breeder kennels who are applying for certification to document that they're actually doing what they say they're doing. And part of that process became having those auditors be able to do the same evaluations we're doing.
Right.
And here's what's really important. We are teaching breeders to do them too. We teach our students to do them because, again, it's really important that you don't have to have a degree in behavior.
Right.
In order to use this tool that we've created to accurately and objectively assess these dogs
right.
to the extent that you can get that as objective as possible. And what's really kind of nice is part of the program, we've built in breeder education.
Nice.
Right? And so part of it is to give people tools they didn't have before. That includes teaching them how we evaluate the dogs, because it's really much more important and much more impactful for them and for their dogs if they know what to look for, because they can fix that every single day that they're there.
Right.
Right? They don't have to wait for someone to come in and say, hey, this isn't working or you're not doing this right. And then they can help each other.
Right. And the explosion guys in the session, they were talking about the dog that, you know, was this and they took it home and they fixed it. So if you know what to fix, that it's a problem.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. The fabulous part of it is what this program sort of forces the breeders to do is to pay better, more individual attention to their dogs, right? They're seeing different things now. For many of them, it's almost like they've had sunglasses removed and they're seeing certain things much more clearly. So that when I walk into a kennel and I'm immediately cued in that even though the dogs look physically healthy, I'm seeing lots of behaviors that worry me, lots of indications of fear. You don't actually see a whole lot of aggression in these dogs,
right.
which is surprising to me,
right.
given that they are intact and mm-hmm. certain hormones should make them a little grumpier.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't really see a ton of that. We see a lot of fear.
Mm-hmm.
I was concerned about that. We see dogs that sometimes look very shut down. We see mm-hmm. dogs that are doing repetitive behaviors. And if you were a dog breeder and you did not know that those are not acceptable, those are not normal, you're not probably attempting to do anything different. So what's kind of fun about this sort of direct breeder education that we're able to do is the breeders are able to see for themselves what is happening with their dogs mm-hmm. and what they're telling us now because they're monitoring more closely.
Mm-hmm.
Several of them have got this really healthy competition going. Some
right.
of them are getting actually pretty darn cocky, right?
right.
They want to show off how much they are doing so that usually when our research team shows up, some of the researchers get to actually do research and I get to do the show and tell us, come look at this. Tell me what you think about this. Is this better? Can you score these dogs? Can
right.
you show me? Because now what they're telling us is they're getting healthier puppies. They're getting bigger litters and healthier animals. They're able to catch. I had one breeder who told me before, you know, you make us weigh those puppies weekly. And I thought this was a huge pain. And I really didn't want to do it. And I'm glad I did it because now I'm catching when they're underweight puppies
right.
and I'm able to help them. And so he's losing fewer dogs.
Fewer dogs.
Right? right? I have people who started off, and I mentioned this in a presentation, they had behavioral problems in their dogs.
Mm-hmm.
I gave the example of we walked into one kennel
right.
and the noise, and the dogs did not calm down. We would sit in there for 20, 30 minutes, and those dogs were constantly barking and loud and clearly hyper-aroused.
Mm.
Some arousal is normal when people walk in.
Right.
But when you walk in with a familiar person and the noise just doesn't stop,
mm-hmm.
that's not okay. It's actually not good for the dogs.
No.
It's not good for people and their hearing, and it's actually bad for the dogs and their hearing, too. And nobody wants to be in that
stress level. They jack each other up.
Yeah, and nobody wants to be in that environment. So odds are, people are spending less time with them. So that's the risk you run, is that because you're spending less time, because you're trying to get in and out really quickly, because it's not a fun environment to be in, you potentially are missing things.
Right.
This same breeder now, I show up to his kennel unannounced, in hopes of collecting a little bit more data as we are on our way out of town. And he proudly shows off to me, one, his enrichment that is now mounted for all the dogs. Mm-hmm. Two, he explains to me what bait bags are and how to give dogs treats, which is fabulous because I think I introduced those to him, but that's okay. You know, and then goes on to tell me, do you hear how quiet they are? And it's so obvious. It's so obvious that even if we weren't taking the metrics, the benchmarks on these dogs, you would notice it. But the fact that we have the data and it is showing up in the data, and that he and other breeders are telling us they like their dogs better, they're spending more time with their dogs. Yeah. That's what it's all about, right? Absolutely. Because it's working for the dogs, which is really important, but it's also working better for the people. And that's totally what makes it worthwhile.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. This will help share the love with others out there in the sport. This has been Pure Dog Talk with your host, Laura Reeves. We hope you can join us next time as we continue on the journey to success with your purebred dog.